In 1968, ITV broadcast an episode of the children's programme Lost in Space, in which Will, the young boy of the family marooned on a faraway planet, discovered that the image he saw when he looked into a mirror was not simply a reflection of himself, but another him entirely, living a separate life on the other side of the glass. I cannot tell you how profound an effect this had on me. It struck me as not only entirely plausible, but just about the most mind-blowing thing I had learned since my brother explained to me that our parents were not related like the rest of us, but simply a boy and girl who'd got together by chance. That information poleaxed me for days afterwards, and similarly, after the space show was over, I sat on the edge of our settee, so mentally exploded that I could not quite conjure up the necessary impetus to lift my rear end fully away from the fabric of our 3P suite. In truth, it always took extra effort to haul oneself away from the sort of deep, heavy sofas favoured by my parents, huge mauve monolithic structures that provided the furniture world's answer to Al Capone's bulletproof car. So, for about 2 minutes, I hovered there, bum slightly raised and vacillating above the cushion, like a jockey entering the home stretch still with a chance of third place. My mind was whirling. How could I have gotten to fully 9 years old without somebody alerting me to this parallel universe lurking just a veneer away, complete with a parallel me? A twin! I always suspected I was. That must be why so many of my contemporaries struck me as slightly backward misfits. But how to make contact with me, stroke him? I figured that in order to get this other self to break cover, I would need to undertake an extended period of staring deep into my own reflection, and for this, absolute privacy would be paramount. The last thing I needed was my father to catch me in the act as I ogled myself, trance-like, nose a half inch from the full-length glass in his wardrobe door, murmuring, "It's all right, you can come out now." This would be as bad as the time he caught me kissing a photo of Dusty Springfield in, coincidentally, the Daily Mirror. On that occasion, I had bluffed my way through the trauma by insisting I had dropped a piece of chewing gum on the paper and was retrieving it no-hand style. For about 2 hours afterwards, I kept walking into his line of sight while theatrically over-chewing a non-existent Wrigley's so he would know how much that piece of gum meant to me. I thought I was carrying this off brilliantly, until he said, "You're fucking gone, you are. Hope there's room in the van when it comes round tonight." The van was a vehicle my old man often referred to. According to him, lunatic asylums toured the streets looking for new inmates, much in the way rag and bone men sought out broken-down gas cookers. Finally, gathering enough wherewithal to escape the pull of our settee's mass, I hurried along the short passage that led to the downstairs toilet, where a fair-sized mirror hung on the wall behind the cistern. Sliding the toilet door closed behind me, I leaned across the fixture itself and stared deep into the convex oval glass. And there I was, or rather, there he was. For some time we regarded each other, neither of us making the slightest move. I figured if I gave it long enough, he would eventually crack, and by dint of his flickering lip or the infinitesimal raising of an eyebrow, we could begin our secret relationship. In the programme, Will had crossed into Mirror World right off the bat and gone off with his reflection to have an adventure. Though this was my ultimate aim, I was sensible enough to realise it would probably take a few more trips to the toilet before we could embark on thrills like that. In fact, even though I tried to communicate telepathically so hard that my eyes were literally bulging out of my head, nothing happened. Which was doubly disappointing, seeing as he appeared to be doing exactly the same thing in trying to contact me. In the end, I relaxed my stare, and in a soupy tone of voice that I hoped would indicate total empathy with his reticence, I said, "I'll be here if ever you want me to come and play." As soon as I said it, I was jolted back into the here and now, all thoughts of a mirror world shattered in an instant as I literally hauled in my neck and stood, hands clenched in horror. How loud had I just said that? The prospect of being overheard was all too real. Not only did this toilet stand a mere 2 feet away from our constantly occupied kitchen, but its frosted glass window was all that separated any occupant from the communal council estate walkway outside. I often remarked on what a basic design flaw it was that, when we were playing football in the square, should one of the little net curtains on these smallest rooms not be fully drawn, it was hard not to notice the fuzzy outline of, say, Lou Brimble at number 13 taking a thundering slash. Understandably, all the women who lived in our block, when seeking to take their ease, would usually wait until the upstairs bathrooms were vacant. So any stray noises issuing from these frankly exposed fixtures had to be carefully guarded against, doubly so in the case of the wistful bilge I had just broadcast. In those unenlightened days, any passing police officer overhearing the phrase, "I'll be here if ever you want me to come and play," coyly emanating from an open lavatory window, was good enough for a couple of years in Pentonville.